because I love black, I love white, I love everyone. The album was, again, mostly instrumental, various versions of songs he'd previously recorded with vocalists and reworking.
And this is Angela Davis. You're listening to CKUT 90.3.
Angela, you're one of a million.
My mom likes this one. But don't let that put you off.
Making space for women's voices, the voice of Hersey. The voice of Hersey. The voice of Hersey coming at ya every Wednesday from 6 to 7.
I wanna know.
Hello, hello. You're tuning into CKUT 90.3 FM, and you just heard Man Enough to Be a Woman by Wayne County and the Electric Chairs. I chose this song because I thought it'd be a great song to introduce the show that I, Cece, am going to be hosting today. This is the Hersey time slot at CCUT, and Jack, our lovely spoken word coordinator, who's in the studio helping me with tech today, recently reached out to see if any volunteers had some show pitches with a feminist theme. And I proposed hosting a show that's going to look at feminist music and musicians and just talk about their music and influence and the era of feminism as well as misogyny that they were living in and experiencing as they were making music. I hope everyone tuning in enjoys the show. I'm really excited to be here. So, as I said, the song just played was Man Enough to Be a Woman by Wayne County and the Electric Chairs. Wayne County was assigned male at birth and given the name Wayne. However, in 1979, she changed her name to Jane as she transitioned. So if you look up this specific song on any streaming platforms, it will be under Wayne County and the Electric Chairs, though she also has music released under Just Wayne County, Just Jane County, and Wayne County and the Backstreet Boys. So if you're interested in hearing more of her music, it's worth looking her up under all four names, as you'll find different releases under each. So Jane was a very formative and even formidable force within the New York punk scene throughout the 70s and into the 80s. And today I'm going to talk about her life, influence in art, and play some of her music throughout. So Jane was born in Dallas, Georgia, into a very conservative Methodist family. However, when Jane was in her early teens, her mother joined a very far-right Christian cult. She said this really tore her family apart. Her dad began having an affair with a 16-year-old, and there were huge fights at home all the time. She was just in this really awful environment growing up, so she ran away from home as a teenager to move to Atlanta, where she first became friends with drag queens, and this is where Jane first began dressing more feminine and growing out her hair, which she said was actually quite dangerous because at the time, and this would have been the 60s, there was a law in Atlanta that could get you arrested for homosexuality if you were a man with hair that touched the top of your ears. So she was getting chased all the time by men trying to attack her. It was very dangerous, as you can imagine, although she said she was a very good runner and never got caught, and she'd always have both a pair of sneakers and high heels with her just in case of danger. However, there was one instance where two men had guns and were shooting at her. She tried to run, calling her queer and trans, and it was obviously quite horrifying. She got out of it alive, but shortly after decided to leave Atlanta. On a less extreme note, she also wanted to leave Atlanta because she said she was considered strange even by her friends who were drag queens, not because of her transgender identity, but because she was into rock and roll, whereas they all liked more soul and pop music. In the book, Please Kill Me, The Uncensored Oral History of Punk, Jane recounts being at a party with these drag queens performing song after song of the Supremes, who were definitely not rock and roll enough for Jane, and saying, I'm going to censor myself here with this quote, quote, I don't want to go to one more effing party where one more effing queen comes out and does an effing Supremes imitation, and if they do, I'm going to effing strangle her, end quote. Jane said that whenever she was given the chance to perform, she'd get up there and perform Janis Joplin. But as I said, her friends didn't like that so much, so eventually she decided to leave Atlanta in pursuit of greater safety and music. She wanted to move to San Francisco because she had this idea of it being the place for people that didn't quite fit in and were considered weird like herself because of the hippie movement that was so prevalent there at the time. However, she said she soon discovered that even the hippies considered her to be strange. So she eventually landed in New York, where the punk movement was just being born with bands like the Velvet Underground. There was another quote in the same book I mentioned, Please Kill Me, that I want to read here because I think it kind of very loosely explains a major cultural difference between the punks and the hippies of this time and offers a kind of explanation as to why Jane likely felt more at home within punk culture. This is a quote from Ed Sanders, an American poet, singer, author, and activist who himself was very involved in hippie culture, however, had this to say about it. Quote, the problem with the hippies was that there developed a hostility within the counterculture itself, between those who had, like, the equivalent of a trust fund versus those who had to live by their wits. It's true, for instance, that many black people were resentful of the hippies by the Summer of Love, 1967, because their perception was that these kids were drawing paisley swirls on their Sam Flax writing pads, burning incense, and taking acid, but those kids could get out of there anytime they wanted to. They could go back home. They could call their mom and say, get me out of here. Whereas someone who was raised in a project on Columbia Street and was hanging out on the edge of Tompkins Square Park can't escape. Those kids don't have any place to go. They can't go back to Great Neck. They can't go back to Connecticut. They can't go back to boarding school in Baltimore. They're trapped. So they developed another kind of more of a lumpen hippie who came from an abused childhood, from parents that hated them, from parents that threw them out. Maybe they came from a religious family that would call them sluts or say, you had an abortion, get out of here, or I found birth control pills in your purse, get out of here, go away. And these kids fermented into a kind of hostile street person, punk types. End quote. Of course, both hippie and punk culture were multidimensional and had more nuance to them than this quote can sum up, but this quote certainly gives us insight as to why someone like Jane, who did grow up in a highly conservative religious household that she had to run away from with no money, would have felt more at home in punk culture than hippie culture, at least at this point of time. So, as I said, Jane ended up settling in New York City, and the first place she sought out was the Stonewall Inn. When she got there, she finally found some sense of belonging. She said the first time she walked through the Stonewall, she was amazed by the people, who she describes as freaky and weird, as well as the fabulous jukebox that was in the corner of the room, which finally played Jane's kind of music. I'm sure most people tuning in have heard of the Stonewall Inn, but I'll give a brief explanation of its history just so you can fully appreciate the significance of Jane discovering it during this period as a young trans woman. The Stonewall, which was originally opened in 1930 and operated as an illegal speakeasy during the Prohibition. It was raided many times because of this, but also possibly because even then it was a queer space, and it is speculated that its name likely came from Mary Casall's autobiography, The Stonewall, which spoke openly of her lesbian relationships and identity. In the 40s, it was transformed into an inn, hence the name Stonewall Inn. Then in the 50s and 60s, it evolved into a restaurant until it was shut down for a brief period in 1966. Now, here's something that was very new to me when I was researching the Stonewall. When it was reopened as the famous gay bar we know it as today, it was actually thanks to four mafiosos of the Genovese crime family in New York. These men had noticed the growing LGBTQ plus community and saw an opportunity to make money running a gay bar. It is also extremely likely that it was only because of this mafia-operated bar that it was able to survive as long as it did, as nearly all other gay bars were shut down in the 60s because it was illegal to serve liquor to LGBTQ plus people. However, if they had protection of the mafia, as the Stonewall did, gay bars were able to survive. Who knew the New York Mafia were such allies of the queer community? Anyways, in 1967, the bar opened back up with a range of all sorts of clientele, except for straight people and undercover cops who would be screened and thrown out at the door. Jane arrived in 1968, a year after its opening, and a year before the Stonewall riots would take place. The Stonewall riots occurred on July 28, 1969, after police raided the bar and its members fought back, notably Marsha P. Johnson and Sylvia Rivera, as well as Jane County. These riots would turn out to be a turning point in queer liberation. Stonewall was shut down shortly afterwards, but Jane found community elsewhere in the punk scenes of New York. She first got involved in the punk scene not through music, but through the underground theater mainly run by John Vaccaro, Charles Ludlam, and Tony Ingrazia, which became known as Ridiculous Theater. The concept of this performance was to visually confront the viewers in a disruptive and disturbing manner. They used props such as huge papier-mâché penises, fake poop, so much glitter would get in the air on the audience members' faces, and they'd even pretend to shoot up speed while on stage. There were many of these performances where the whole audience would clear out before the show was even finished because they were so disturbed. When Jane would later go on to form a band and perform live shows, she would use a similar kind of interactive and aggressive performance, saying that oftentimes her goal was to have people leave her show before she was finished. She wanted to create that kind of reactionary response that meant she was reaching people. Within theater, Jane, who was still identifying as a man at this time, was able to experiment and play with gender performance on stage, most notably in her first performance in Femme Fatale, where she played a lesbian prisoner. After this performance, she went on to write her own play, World, Birth of a Nation, which had themes of homosexual desire and male castration. It was from her performance in her own play, World, Birth of a Nation, that she would land a role in Andy Warhol's Pork, which she played a character quite literally named Vulva. Pork ended up doing so well that they traveled to London to perform, where Jane met David Bowie, about whom she says, quote, "We'd heard that this David Bowie was supposed to be androgynous and everything, but then he came out with this long hair, folky clothes, and sat on a stool and played folk songs. We were so disappointed with him. We looked over at him and said, 'Just look at that folky old hippie.' We were sitting in the audience with our black fingernails and dyed hair. You couldn't get any of those bright punk colors back then, but Lee Childers had gotten a magic marker and colored all his hair different bright colors." End quote. So, of course, David Bowie had heard of Jane and Her Friends because of the success of Pork in England. So after a show, he took them all out to a gay bar, and they ended up spending a lot of time with him while in England, which Jane said made him drastically change his look from this folky hippie thing, as she calls it. She says about him, quote, "After us, David started getting dressed up. I'd gotten the shaved eyebrows thing from Jackie Curtis, and David started shaving his eyebrows, painting his nails, even wearing painted nails out at nightclubs like we were doing. He changed his whole image and started getting more and more freaky." I just love this quote of Jane's because she so unabashedly claims herself as the inspiration of David Bowie's iconic Ziggy Stardust look, which I think a lot of people think of being as invented by Bowie and authentically his. But as is the case with so much of, if not all, mainstream pop culture, its inspiration is usually derived from people's deviant and non-conforming identities that themselves can't fit into the mainstream culture, but create their own looks and culture within their communities that, when it's taken up or appropriated by someone like David Bowie, a white cisgender boy from a middle-class upbringing in England, compared to someone like Jane, it is accepted by mainstream culture. Now, in this particular situation, I'm not saying that David Bowie was stealing anything from this culture in a necessarily wrong way, but it is a great example of how much of our culture is inspired by trans women and other minorities who never receive the attention and praise for the cultures and art they create in the same way that those who just take their culture are praised for it, which is wrong. Jane even did some free demos for Bowie because he was so impressed with her music and lyrics as well, which she completely regrets now because she claims he stole much of her lyrics, specifically that his hit song Rebel Rebel was ripped off from her song Queenage Baby. Now, I'm not going to play Rebel Rebel because it's probably top 40 and I'm sure most listeners know the song, but here's a live performance of Jane's Queenage Baby, and you can decide for yourself if you hear the resemblance.
We wish to welcome you all to our show, ladies and ladies, sorry, but after all, I mean, we have rehearsed this show so hard, and especially just for you people, right, boys? You bet your balls. This next number we have for you, it's about queenagers. You know, queenagers are the big rave today. Queenage heaven, a queenager in love. Well, we got a song called Queenage Baby. Hit it, boys. Vampire.
Queen A's baby, last name for day. Queen A's baby, you'll be a race in the first degree.
Montreal Cultural Association proudly announces its fundraising campaign for the GEMSTAR Circle of Excellence program, supporting high-achieving grade 11 students in Montreal's Black community.
In partnership with the West Island Black Community Association as our fiduciary, this initiative provides scholarships, mentorship, and leadership development to empower the next generation of Black leaders.
Your donation can make a real difference, helping us students thrive academically, professionally, and personally.
Visit PlayMassMontreal.com, that's PlayMassMontreal.com, to contribute today. All donations are eligible for a tax receipt.
Together, let's invest in the future of our community.
This message is brought to you by PlayMass Montreal and CKUT 90.3 FM.
You just heard Queen Age Baby by Wayne County. So this leads us into Jane's career as a musician. The first band she formed was Queen Elizabeth and was shortly after signed by Main Man artist David Bowie's management firm. However, Main Man would never produce any records for Jane's band, and it is widely assumed that Jane was actually signed on to help Bowie gain credibility within the music scene through displaying his association with these more out there and attention-grabbing people like Jane. This is something Jane had to deal with a lot throughout her career, as being viewed as like a token freak that people could use like an object to show that they were in with this crowd of deviants and artists. Oftentimes, she would be invited to parties by the New York elite to find out later that what was expected from her was not just the company of any guest, but to be the entertainment and shock value for all other guests to kind of gawk at. This objectification was not only emotionally hurtful and dehumanizing for Jane, but it also harmed her career, as she was not viewed as a legitimate artist, but just as a token figure of validation for other more mainstream artists. This was evident by Bowie's relationship with her, such as the free demos he got from her that I mentioned earlier. Further, Main Man, Bowie's management firm, filmed a stage show of Jane's band, Queen Elizabeth, entitled it Wayne at the Trucks, which was artistically directed by Jane, but its footage was never released. Later that year, Jane and her band saw Bowie's Diamond Dogs tour, just to realize he had taken much of Jane's artistic direction from her show, with no credit afforded to her. As it became clear that Jane's band, Queen Elizabeth, was going nowhere, they were disbanded and Jane formed Wayne County and the Backstreet Boys back in New York. They would regularly perform at CBGB's and Max's Kansas City, the latter which would create a compilation featuring multiple artists titled Max's Kansas City, New York New Wave, which Wayne County and the Backstreet Boys recorded three tracks for. Here's one of them that paints a great picture of just what it was like to be hanging out in the punk scene in New York at this time.
Take a tip from me and get ready for the big parade. The place to be, every night's a happy holiday. The kids are jumping around, everybody's doing loop-de-loop. Just a making the rounds like a speed freak in a telephone booth. The downstairs is packed and the groupies are all dressed up. Upstairs, the New York Dolls are kicking it. personality crisis, baby. Down at Max's
Canister.
All the boys are
Max's Canister.
All the girls are
Max's Canister.
All the stars are
Max's Canister.
Down at Max's. I see Patti Smith, she's the stagger me up rock and roll. She threw a 7 and 11, and she always knows which parts to hold. And I see Lou Reed and Iggy Pop, they're just getting higher and higher. Give those boys one more drink, and they're gonna set the place on fire. Go get them, boys! The downstairs is packed, and the groupies are all dressed up. Upstairs, the New York Dolls are kicking it out, looking tough. Bad girl is a looking for a kid. Down at Max's,
Max's Canister.
All the boys are
Max's Canister.
All the girls are
Max's Canister.
Stars up.
Max's
Canister. Down at Max's. Blondie's all in a buzz. She's on the cover of the New York Rocker. D.D. Ramone strips his bass to the bone. He's a blitzkrieg bopper. The Heartbreakers are gonna give you a taste of going steady with pirate love. And you better watch it, because my Backstreet Boys are gonna rip you apart. Rip them up, boys! The downstairs is packed, and the groupies are all dressed up. Upstairs, the New York Dolls are kicking it out. Looking tough. Tracks, pick it up. You know where. That's right. Down at Max's. All the boys are
Max's Canister.
All the girls are
Max's Canister.
All the stars
Max's Canister.
Down at Max's. Now I ain't talking about San Francisco, and I ain't talking about Los Angeles, and I ain't talking about Detroit City. I'm talking about New York City, down at Max's, Kansas City, baby. Hey man, what's happening? Where you going tonight? Well, I think I'm gonna go down to Max's and check out a couple of rock and roll bands. Oh yeah? Who's playing there these days? Well, there's the Heartbreakers, Cherry Vanilla and a Staten Island Band, Wayne County and the Backstreet Boys, the Fast Para Ubu, John Collins, Para Toledo, Suicide, the Ramones, Blondie, the Dolls, Television, Talking Heads, August, Views, Mom, the Poppies, the Marbles, the Planets, the Miamis, Just Water, Tough Dark, Dale Bread, Richard Hale, Lance Loud and the Mumps, Another Pretty Face, and Mink DeVille, and phew. Oh yeah, they got this new group that everybody's talking about called the Psychotic Frogs. Hey, wait, just a minute. There's just one more thing I forgot to tell you. You better not forget to bring your masquerade mask and your ego trip, because you're gonna need it when you go down to Max's Kansas City, baby. That's right.
You are tuning into CKUT 90.3 FM, and that was Wayne County and the Backstreet Boys, Max's Kansas City, 1976, Parts 1 and 2. Jane and the Backstreet Boys stuck together from 74 to 76, but in 1977, she traveled once again to London to put together a new band called Wayne County and the Electric Chairs, recording 3 albums and numerous singles with them, while also continuing to dabble in acting while in London, notably acting in Derek Jarman's punk film Jubilee, playing an androgynous lizard who went by both he, him, and she, her pronouns. During this time she was in Europe, Jane moved to Berlin for a period of time near the end of the 70s and into the early 80s. She said she had never been in a place where she felt more accepted for who she was as a trans woman. In Berlin, she felt the most free and safe that she ever had. It was in Berlin that she first openly identified as a woman and changed her name to Jane. Here's a song by Wayne County and the Electric Chairs titled Berlin about her time there.
Berlin.
That was Berlin by Wayne County and the Electric Chairs, and you're tuning into CKUT 90.3 FM. Upon returning to New York in the 80s, Jane broadcasted her name change to all of New York City by putting up posters all around announcing her upcoming performance at CBGB's with Wayne County spelled out in big letters, but with the W in Wayne crossed out with a big pink J on top. Jane said that the New York punk music scene was very accepting of her transition for the most part. However, this was not always the case. Back in 1976, which would have been 3 years before she changed her name to Jane, but as she had just begun taking hormones, an infamous altercation happened between her and Dick Manitoba of the band The Dictators. Dick was actually a fan of Jane's music at the time, although he was more so into the act of her performance itself. He thought it was really funny and entertaining. Part of what Dick Manitoba wanted in these kind of performances was to be engaged with the performer as an audience member, so he was yelling stuff at Jane all night and expecting some kind of response back. However, the stuff he was yelling at her was completely inappropriate heckling directed at a trans woman from a cishet man. Furthermore, Jane and Dick had never met, and from her vantage point on stage, Jane couldn't see his face to realize that it was a member of the Dictators yelling at her. All she could tell for certain was that a man was shouting slurs at her from the audience, the same kind of slurs she would have heard as she ran for her life from other men when living in Atlanta. Dick then got up to use the bathroom, and the way that CBGB's was laid out, you had to cross the stage to get to the bathroom. So upon seeing that this man shouting at her was coming up on stage, Jane entered fight-or-flight mode, and her reaction was to fight, swinging her microphone stand towards his shoulder, hard and fast enough that, had it been any higher, it would have killed him. He then immediately grabbed Jane, and a fight broke out, after which Dick was sent to the hospital, and Jane continued her performance, now covered in blood. Jane had a gig at the time as a DJ at Max's Kansas City that she continued to show up to the nights following this, donning a fake mustache and dyeing her blonde hair black in an attempt to hide from the police who were looking for her. However, they eventually found her anyways, and she was sent to jail for a short period of time after this. Jane has said she felt quite bad about what happened, but in that moment, all she knew was that a man was yelling words like queer at her, and she thought he had only the worst intentions, like so many other men she'd had to deal with in the past. She truly feared for her life in that moment when he got up on the stage. This whole horrible situation opened a lot of eyes within the punk scene towards the lived reality of the queer and particularly trans woman that these cishet punk rockers were friends with and whom they accepted, but hadn't until then been able to grasp how dangerous it was for them in the world. There seemed to be a bit of an idea within the punk community that since everybody in there was kind of like an outsider, someone who couldn't fit in and doesn't belong to the rest of the society, but that they can fit in within the punk community, that they're all kind of like the same, no matter what your gender or sexuality is. So this event disrupted this notion and made it clear to them that transphobic hate can enter any community, and its effect is not something that Jane and other trans women around her could just shrug off when they entered a more welcoming space like CBGB's. In the book, Please Kill Me, Bob Gruen, a prominent author and photographer of the rock and roll scene at this time, said of the incident, quote, "It was kind of an interesting thing, because although there were a lot of gay people on the scene, it wasn't spoken of that much. I mean, certainly Wayne was not in the closet, but most of the other guys who were around rock and roll were kind of heterosexual, macho males. For me, I felt that it was kind of a turning point, that all these guys had to fess up and say that Wayne's our friend and we stand up for him, and it's not okay to come into a club and call a guy queer. It's not okay." And I just want to note here that Jane was using he, him pronouns and going by Wayne at the time of this quote, so Bob was not misgendering her at this time. So a bunch of Jane's friends came together and played a benefit to help her with her legal bills. Blondie, Patti Smith, Suicide, and the New York Dolls all played at the benefit, and there was a sort of coming together for both the punk and gay liberation movements of that time. Though later on, when it became clear to a lot of people who initially had supported Jane on this issue, such as Debbie Harry and Dee Dee Ramone, that Jane was actually the initiator in the physical part of this fight, they apologized to Dick Manitoba and more so took his side on the issue. However, this did not change the eye-opening nature of the whole incident that made many see just how much trauma and danger was experienced by a woman like Jane because of incidents like this that would evoke such strong physical reactions in an attempt to protect themselves. In England, where Jane also performed often, she had a similar experience of the punk scene initially being very open and welcoming to all sorts of genders and sexualities. However, she found as time went on and the movement became more mainstream and picked up by the British tabloids, it was less and less welcoming. In a piece written by Jane on punk77.uk, she said about her first couple of times performing in England, quote, "The reaction at the Roxy was phenomenal, and no, no abuse at all. I was well loved by the Roxy crowd, and they all knew who I was. A lot of the punks had been Bowie, glam fans. The place was packed, you couldn't move, and the place was full of all the punk celebrities. Members from just about all the bands were there. They loved me. And besides, some of the punks were gay or bi in those days, whether out or not. In the beginning, punk was not so homo or transphobic. That happened later when the movement was taken over by fake punks and skinheads." End quote. However, as time went on and she came back in the 80s to perform again in London, at this point, with a new name and using she/her pronouns, she said that the reaction from the London punk scene towards transgender people had totally changed, and she got a lot of hate, especially since the British press was now heavily following the newly erupting punk culture that they deemed to be dangerous. She said that new and old fans in London, who were used to her as Wayne, didn't want to acknowledge her transgender identity, especially now that she was on hormones and outwardly appeared quite different than the Wayne they had seen a few years back. This reluctance to accept her physical body was a big problem for Jane because a big part of her performance was the emphasis she displayed on sexuality and physicality in her shows, and she did not want to have to cover up. However, she soon discovered that the only way to survive these shows in London was to do so. Whereas in New York, she said she could still, quote, let it all hang out. So Jane performing in New York because she could not stand to cover up any part of herself that she didn't want to, whether that be her body or her mind. As she said in a ripped and torn interview in 1978, quote, "The point is, I'm a human being. It doesn't matter what sex I am, I'm Wayne County. I had to create an alternative lifestyle for myself, or I couldn't have lived." This unapologetic and open nature of Jane's is exemplified perfectly in a song released by Wayne County and the Electric Chairs in 1978 titled Fuck Off. Here it is.
You don't wanna fuck me, baby, baby, fuck off. If you don't wanna fuck me, baby, baby, fuck off. I ain't got time for yesterday's news. Don't shoot me up with your bullshit news. If you don't wanna fuck me, baby, baby, fuck off. If you don't want a piece of the action, baby, take a walk. If you don't want a piece of the action, baby, take a walk. I don't like it when you play with my knees. You ain't nothing but a prick tease. If you don't want a piece of the action, baby, take a walk. There's a door, punch your hurry. That you're hot shit, I heard. You ain't nothing but a cold turd. If you don't wanna fuck me, baby, baby, fuck off. One, two, three, four. We'll be right back.
That was Fuck Off by Wayne County and the Electric Chairs, and you're tuning in to CKUT 90.3 FM. After splitting from Wayne County and the Electric Chairs in the 80s and following her fight with the dictators Dick Manitoba, Jane took a brief break from music to focus once again on her acting career, appearing in the theatrical production Les Girls with old friend and theater companion Holly Woodlin. She also traveled to London to play Layla in the film City of Lost Souls. While she was in London during the premiere of this film, she was approached by Warren Highway, who offered to manage her. He ended up putting together a band for her, and they released her 1986 album, Private Oyster. This album, along with her 1989 album, Betty Grable's Legs, and the single Time Machine, propelled her back into the spotlight of the punk music scene, and she went back on tour, eventually returned to New York City, where she reunited with the Electric Chairs, who would stay together from 1989 to 1997, now called Jane County and the Electric Chairs. They toured both Europe and the U.S. When her manager, Warren Highway, passed away in 2005, Jane decided to move back to Atlanta, where she formed the band The Electric Queers, who performed often, but only ever released one single, Ready to Stop, which is about saying no to bigotry and hate in all forms, especially in its systematic forms, something Jane was always very vocal about, saying on punk77.uk, quote, "I think of myself as a trailblazer, like Lewis and Clark, a punk pioneer, and the fact that I'm transgender makes it all the more special. No, I never had mass appeal, but I'm still going strong, and I am an established artist. Still touring, still recording, still breathing, still kicking ass, and still saying, fuck you, to the rest of the world. I pride myself on being an original and staunch individual. Still chipping away at that fucking wall, causing trouble, defying the government and stirring up the mischief, throwing cow shit in the face of authority and screwing the establishment, being a bad example for the kids and upsetting all the parents," end quote. Here it is, Ready to Stop by The Electric Queers.
Are you ready? Ready to rock?
You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM, and that was Ready to Stop by the Electric Queers. When in Atlanta, Jane began to focus more heavily on her artwork, as Jane said that being a painter had always been her most early aspirations as a little girl. Just as she had always done with both her acting and music careers, Jane's artwork explores themes of gender and sexual fluidity. It is always bright and colorful work, usually depicting feminine goddess-type figures with multiple breasts or penises whose gaze is directed at the viewer of the image, invoking the confrontational feeling Jane is a fan of creating within all forms of her artistic career. The last piece of music Jane released was in 2020 with Am Taylor, titled I Don't Fit In Anywhere. About this song, Jane said, quote, basically the story of my life. I don't fit in anywhere, but this is for any trans people or anybody, straight, trans, whatever, that feels like they don't fit in anywhere. But if punk taught us anything, it taught us that we can do it ourselves. Here it is, I Don't Fit In Anywhere by Jane County and Am Taylor.
Anywhere, anywhere, anywhere. cause that's the right thing. Yeah, I wanna be with you in the nighttime, cause that's the right time. In the nighttime, yeah, that's the right time. Alright.
You have been listening to Hersey on CKUT 90.3 FM, CKUT.ca on the web. This time slot usually would have been in the Motherhood, but you may know that the host of that show, Robin Fadden, passed away earlier this year. So we dedicate this song to her memory. And you have been listening to a spotlight on Jane County with Cece. So stay tuned to see what the future holds for Hersey and In the Motherhood. We'll be back at you with feminist programming next week, and you're about to hear Harbinger Media. So thanks for listening, and we'll just listen to a little bit more Jane County to play us out for the night. Oh, do you want to play something else?
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Society and culture from a progressive perspective. Find out more about the community and subscribe to our weekly newsletter at harbingermedianetwork.com. On this episode, we're presenting a special extra-length The Breach Show 55-minute episode featuring Martin Lukacs and Desmond Cole, reflecting on the end of Justin Trudeau's near decade in power. But first, this episode's brought to you by the Canadian journalism community Unrigged. Launched November 2023, Unrigged.ca is your one-stop website highlighting the latest in socially and politically progressive journalism, podcasts, and videos from 25 publishers across the country. It's a collaboration featuring nonprofit outlets like Briar Patch Magazine in Regina, The Independent in St. John's, and the Coop de Solidarité Pivot in Montreal, and national news publishers like The Maple, Press Progress, and Ricochet, and 18 more. Check it out now at Unrigged.ca. And broadcasting since 2022, The Breach Show is a bi-weekly podcast featuring sharp commentary on politics and movements in Canada. On the show's 39th episode, new Breach contributor